Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week in Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science. And today on Exploration, we're going to depart from our usual format and instead answer some of the emails that I get. And once again, it's impossible to answer all the emails that come flooding into my mailbox, so I'm going to group them into categories and try to answer some of them today. First of all, many people have asked my opinion about the Space Force. President Donald Trump has said that we need a new branch of the military, beyond just the Air Force and the Army and the Navy and the Coast Guard and the Marines. No, he's talking about a Space Force to dominate outer space. And the question is, what are the pros and cons of a Space Force? And then Mars. Did you know that at the end of July, Mars is going to be in opposition? This is a great opportunity to see Mars as one of the brightest objects in the night sky. That's right, you'll see this reddish-orange dot if you face south and near the end of July. And it means that we are in the closest approach to the red planet. And not only that, but we also have satellites that are converging on Mars. And we'll see a few things about the latest developments about the red planet. And then we'll see a few things about life in outer space. I get a lot of emails asking me, well, what is your opinion about whether or not there are aliens in outer space? How come they don't visit us? And what are they like anyway? Well, let's just jump right into some of the top stories of the past week. The number one question that I get in email concerns outer space, and specifically that's Donald Trump's plan to create a new space force. Now, to be fair, there are pluses and minuses to creating a new space force. First of all, let's not be naive. The Chinese and the Russians, they are experimenting with advanced weapons in outer space. For example, about 10 years ago, the Chinese displayed a certain amount of expertise in killer satellite warfare by literally blowing up one of their own satellites. That's right, there were two Chinese satellites. The first one shot some kind of projectile at the second Chinese satellite and blew it up. As a consequence, thousands of pieces of debris were created in outer space, creating an uproar. Because, of course, we don't need more space junk in outer space, and we don't need to test these weapons that could destroy our satellites. Well, because of that, the Chinese have not tested their killer satellite technology since then. However, let's be clear about this. The Russians, the Chinese, and the United States, all of them have the capability of knocking out satellites in outer space. And that would be the first phase of a war in outer space. Think of two gunfighters, where one gunfighter has the ability to reach down, grab sand, and throw sand in the enemy's eyes, blinding them and rendering them pretty much harmless. In other words, in a opening shots of a nuclear war in outer space, the first thing that a nation would do is to blind the enemy by knocking out their satellites. In that way, communications, reconnaissance, GPS, all of that would be wiped out, leaving the enemy pretty much helpless. And also, let me be clear, back in March, Vladimir Putin boasted of the fact that he's fielding a new type of nuclear weapon. That's right, a nuclear weapon beyond the usual ICBM. It's called the hypersonic weapon. Now, to be fair, the United States has also tested the hypersonic weapon and has pretty much abandoned it because it's too unstable. But let me explain. When an ICBM goes up into the atmosphere, eventually it has to come down to strike its target. At that point, the ICBM is vulnerable to anti-missile technology, which might shoot down that missile. However, if the missile releases a hypersonic device, a device that travels many times faster than the speed of sound, it's almost like an airplane. It can maneuver and therefore evade any Star Wars system. In fact, Vladimir Putin boasted of the fact that it has tested its hypersonic weapon and it would effectively neutralize any Star Wars weapon created by the United States. So on one hand, the people who believe in a space force say that, well, the Russians have these weapons, the Chinese have their weapons, and we should not be caught flat-footed. Not to mention the fact that other countries are getting in the game. The Indians, for example, show their prowess in outer space by shooting a space probe all the way to Mars on the first try. That was really a tour de force. And some people think that we could literally have a traffic jam around the moon, as the Chinese, the Indians, the Japanese, the Russians, the European Union, that all these countries begin to go back to the moon. So, say some people, we need a cop on the block. For peaceful purposes, not for warlike purposes, we need a cop on the block to make sure that space is not nuclearized. Well, those are the pro reasons for having a new space force. However, there are also con reasons as well. First of all, let's be clear about this. Who is the most vulnerable to escalating into a new arms race in outer space? It's the United States. We have by far the largest investment in satellite technology in terms of the internet, telecommunications, the GPS, you name it. The United States is leading in that category in outer space. And so we are the most vulnerable if space gets militarized. You know, the Chinese have an expression, never pick up a rock, only to drop it on your own feet. And some people think that that's what it could be. If we start an arms race in outer space, say the critics, let's be clear. The Russians have already stated that they too will join in an arms race. And where is it going to lead? And then the next question, if you really want to destabilize and blind an enemy in the opening shots of a war, the simplest way to do it is to detonate an atomic or thermonuclear weapon in outer space, releasing the electromagnetic pulse capable of wiping out communications for thousands of miles. Now, we know this because the United States in the past has actually detonated hydrogen warheads in outer space, creating havoc. Once the United States detonated a nuclear weapon over the Pacific, and the shockwave, the electromagnetic shockwave released from that burst of nuclear energy interfered with telecommunications between San Francisco and Tokyo, and even burglar alarms. Burglar alarms were set off in Hawaii as a consequence. Physicists have since analyzed that detonation very carefully and have come to the conclusion that if that warhead is strategically placed, let's say, over Kansas, at the right altitude, at the right time, it could literally paralyze the electronics of the United States. This means that power plants would shut down because of short circuits. It means that satellites would be fried in outer space, rendering them useless. It means that telecommunications would be disrupted. It means that power would go down. I mean, think about the chaos that would erupt. In the long term, for example, refrigerators would go down. The food in your refrigerator would very quickly rot, and there would be food riots. In other words, we would be thrown back 100, 200 years into the past if just one nuclear bomb were strategically placed right over the United States. And that is the power of the electromagnetic pulse. You see, a nuclear weapon is much more dangerous in outer space than it is on the planet Earth. If you detonate a nuclear warhead, let's say in a major metropolitan city, the devastation would be measured in tens of miles. However, if you detonate that same weapon in outer space, the electromagnetic pulse, it would be measured in hundreds of miles, thereby rendering your telecommunications network inoperable. In fact, you don't even have to use sophisticated nuclear weapons. Let's say a small country has the ability to field a satellite and simply puts a barrel of nails in outer space. If you were to detonate an ordinary barrel of nails in outer space, you could wipe out hundreds of satellites that orbit the planet Earth. Now, of course, that will not create an electromagnetic pulse. But think of the havoc. Think of the havoc that's going to be unleashed if somebody were to paralyze our satellite force by doing something as simple as detonating a barrel of nails in outer space. The other problem with a Space Force is the cost and the bureaucracy. The United States Air Force already has command of much of our nuclear forces and our forces in outer space, and it would mean another layer of bureaucracy, which is going to cost money as a consequence. So what do we do about this? Well, perhaps the solution is not so distant. You see, back in 1967, the nations of the world signed the Outer Space Treaty. The Outer Space Treaty basically said that nuclear weapons, weapons of mass destruction, should not be deployed in outer space, and that nations cannot own celestial bodies like the moon. Two very simple provisions. However, that was 1967. That treaty is way out of date for many reasons. First of all, although it bans the use of nuclear weapons in outer space, it says nothing about non-nuclear weapons in outer space. For example, about 10 years ago, when the Chinese knocked out one of their own satellites, many scientists believed that it was a projectile of some sort. A projectile that was shot in the direction of the other satellite, blowing it apart. So it wasn't that sophisticated. It wasn't a nuclear device to kill a satellite. And these weapons are not banned under the Outer Space Treaty of 1967. Or think of laser weapons. Of course, President Ronald Reagan put the initiative on the Star Wars program to use laser beams to shoot down nuclear weapons in space. But laser weapons are not weapons of mass destruction. They are not covered by the Outer Space Treaty of 1967. Not to mention the fact that even though nations cannot own the moon, what about private individuals? Can they stake a flag on the moon and say, I want this to be the location of my new condo or my new office? Well, believe it or not, back in 1967, no one foresaw the fact that independent billionaires could become a space force in and of themselves. Who would have foreseen the fact that Elon Musk of SpaceX can create his own moon rocket, the Falcon Heavy, fully capable of reaching the moon with the Dragon capsule? Who would have thought back in 1967 that one man, or two men if you include Jeff Bezos of Amazon.com, could field a whole array of rockets which can reach outer space and reach the moon and perhaps even reach Mars? Who would have thought that? So I think the lesson here is, first of all, before we create a space force, we should revise the Outer Space Treaty of 1967. We need ground rules. Even if we do go forward with the space force, we still need ground rules to make sure that space is not nuclearized, that space is not weaponized, because, as I mentioned, who stands to lose the most when space is weaponized? We are the big losers in that situation. Also, speaking about outer space, Mars is in the news. First of all, in the end of July, you're going to have a treat. Look up in the night sky, face south, and look at a long arc that goes from southeast to southwest. That long, lazy arc across the sky is the ecliptic plane. And that's where the planets are. The planets all line up in a disk. And you can have a treat. You'll be able to see not just the planets, but also Mars at its closest point. And it'll be one of the brightest objects in the night sky. And yes, it'll be red, reddish-orange. And that's one of the reasons why the Greeks and the Romans named it after the god of war. Mars is blood red. However, in reality, I should point out that Mars is actually the rusty planet. The reason why Mars is red is because of iron oxide. The oxygen in the atmosphere of Mars, whatever oxygen it had, began to oxidize with the iron chemicals in the soil to create red sand. And that's why Mars is red. Now, there's no need for binoculars, by the way. In fact, binoculars would be rather useless. If you have binoculars and tune it to Mars, you're not going to see much because Mars is really far away. You're talking about millions and millions of miles away. So even without binoculars, you'll be given a treat if you face south in the end of July to look for the red planet. And then we should also point out that just a few weeks ago, NASA had that huge press conference where it announced the fact that a big discovery has been made about Mars. In fact, there was an embargo on the press release because the press release was deemed to be so sensitive. However, I hate to be the party pooper. However, the NASA press release simply said that our latest space probes on Mars have detected organic chemicals on the red planet. Now, does that mean life has been discovered on Mars? No. Organic chemicals simply means chemicals that contain carbon, oxygen, and hydrogen. Not even amino acids. Now, think of what your body is made of. Your body is basically made out of proteins. These proteins, in turn, can be broken down to amino acids. And these amino acids, in turn, are hydrocarbons. So these hydrocarbons were found on Mars. But amino acids? Not yet. I should also point out, in all fairness, that we have seen amino acids everywhere in the universe. For example, meteors. When meteors come and strike the Earth, they become meteorites. And if you split open a meteorite, sure enough, you can find traces of amino acids in the heart of meteorites. Also, with our instruments, we can zero in on gas clouds in outer space, many, many light years away, nebulas. And it turns out that, yes, you see evidence of the spectral light coming from amino acids in these nebulae. Now, what does that mean? That means that the building blocks of life, amino acids, even though we haven't found them on Mars yet, the building blocks of life could be everywhere throughout the universe. On planets, asteroids, meteors, dust clouds, everywhere we look, we see the evidence of the chemicals which may make possible life in the universe. And speaking about life in the universe, I should point out that TESS and the Webb Space Telescope are going to be game changers in the future. In the past few decades, two satellites have given us enormous amounts of information about the universe. The first is the Hubble Space Telescope. In fact, it's perhaps one of the most productive instruments of science ever built, a bargain for just $1 billion, the Hubble Space Telescope. It's been able to peer into planets and black holes and answer many of the mysteries concerning the universe. The other great discoveries were made by the Kepler satellite, a satellite which was able to confirm 4,000 planets orbiting other stars in our galaxy. And the Kepler satellite even gave us a census of the Milky Way galaxy. For the first time, we now know that on average, every single star we see in the heavens has a planet going around it. That's amazing. On average, every star has a planet going around it. And about 1 in 20 of them, in turn, have Earth-sized planets going around them. So in other words, the basics of life, that is having a planet the size of the planet Earth and the right distance from the sun, may be much more plentiful than we originally thought. Now, one question I get in the emails is, well, we have all this data, all this fantastic amount of data. Can we now say definitively, one way or the other, the probability of life and intelligent life in the universe? And the answer to that, sadly, is no. Because on one hand, we're now flooded with data from thousands of planets orbiting other stars. About 20 of them, by the way, are very much like the Earth, except perhaps a little bit bigger than the planet Earth, and perhaps a little bit hotter than the planet Earth. But we see about 20 of them that are almost twins of the planet Earth. So on one hand, we have much more data points to work with. But on the other hand, the sad news is, we now realize that life, that is, the creation of DNA and eventually people, is extremely difficult. And we see more and more hurdles facing any planet out there that may one day harbor life. For example, look at our moon. Our moon is actually rather unusual because it's rather large, but it helps us stabilize the Earth. Without the moon, on a scale of a few million years, the Earth would tumble. making life impossible on the planet Earth. So our solar system needs a planet with a large moon, and not every planet has that. And then take a look at Jupiter. Computer programs show that if Jupiter did not exist, then Jupiter, the vacuum cleaner, would not have cleaned out the early solar system of the comets and asteroids and debris, and we would be constantly hit by gigantic meteors every few years, making life, once again, impossible on the planet Earth. So we're now beginning to realize with our computer models that it is rather difficult to get an Earth-like planet of the right size that has a stable environment for billions of years so that Jupiter cleaned out most of the debris of the early solar system. And not just one, two, or three, but scores of different hurdles face us. For example, we now know that at one point the Earth was completely covered in ice. Snowball Earth, we call it, making life extremely difficult. So life was nearly extinguished at that point when the Earth was completely blanketed by ice. And we now know that intelligent life is much more difficult to get off the ground because many times in the past, humanity was almost wiped out. 70,000 years ago or so, there was a catastrophe which hit Homo sapiens, and only a handful of us, a few hundred, maybe a thousand, escaped that devastation. And then we, the survivors, the handful of Homo sapiens who survived that catastrophe, went on to repopulate the entire planet Earth. What was that event? We think it was, though we can't prove, the eruption of the Toba volcano in Indonesia. That volcano was sufficient to blanket Africa, to cause temperatures to plunge. Many animals went extinct, and we almost went extinct as well. Now, although it's very difficult to get intelligent life off the ground, there's some people who believe that, well, of course there are aliens in outer space, and they know that because they've been kidnapped. They've been abducted by the aliens. They know that, yes, indeed, there are aliens out there in outer space that have made contact with humans and have even kidnapped us. Well, I have a word of advice for those people that claim to have been abducted by flying saucer people. The next time you are in a flying saucer, for God's sake, steal something. I don't care what it is. An alien chip, an alien hammer, an alien paperclip, anything. Alien dandruff, alien DNA. I don't care what you can grab or steal. And remember, there's no law against stealing from an extraterrestrial. You're not going to go to jail for stealing a microchip from an extraterrestrial. However, you will have bragging rights. You will be able to end the debate once and for all. You know, without hard evidence, we're going to be debating flying saucers and UFOs thousands of years into the future. Are they nothing but a figment of our imagination, or are they real evidence of visitations? It's not something that is decidable with present-day technology. But you can end the debate right then and there if you steal something the next time you are kidnapped by a flying saucer. And then another question I get in my emails is, come on, give me a break, they say. It's expensive. It's really expensive going into outer space. Why bother? Well, I had Carl Sagan on the airwaves on Exploration, and I asked him that very same question. Space is really, really expensive. So why bother to go? Well, it turns out that space is getting cheaper every year. For example, the Indian government sent a space probe all the way to Mars for $70 million. Now, Hollywood created a movie about going to Mars, The Martian, with Matt Damon. That movie cost $100 million. In other words, a Hollywood movie now about going to Mars costs more than actually going to Mars. That's how cheap space flight has become, so that even small nations with a fledgling space fleet can now send rockets into outer space to explore the universe. And Elon Musk wants to have reusable rockets. Just like the used car market revolutionized the car industry and car sales in America, changing American culture, in fact, with the car, It turns out that now used rockets are going to revolutionize the pricing of rockets to take us into outer space. It costs $10,000 to put a pound of anything into orbit around the Earth. $10,000 a pound. That's your weight in gold. Think of your body made out of solid gold. That's what it costs to put you in orbit around the Earth. However, Elon Musk wants to get it down to $1,000 a pound. So in other words, by a factor of 10, reducing the cost of space travel, literally opening up outer space to the average person. In fact, Elon Musk of SpaceX has even bigger dreams. He eventually wants to put 1 million colonists on Mars. 1 million. He has big dreams. Now, we should point out, of course, that this has to be done in stages. In my new book, The Future of Humanity, which was a New York Times bestseller, I lay out the steps necessary to begin the long, arduous process of colonizing Mars. First is use lava tubes that already exist to create a Mars base. Second, mining operations. The first thing to mine is ice. Mars has plenty of ice. Ice can be melted to create drinking water. It can be chemically treated to give us hydrogen and oxygen for rocket fuel and for breathing. So mining ice to create the first mining operations on Mars. Then more longer term, agriculture, creating genetically modified algae, genetically modified crops that would thrive in the carbon dioxide atmosphere of Mars, because of course plants love carbon dioxide. And the atmosphere of Mars is almost pure carbon dioxide. So create genetically modified plant organisms that can thrive in the cold atmosphere of Mars. And then long-term, satellites that can direct sunlight down to the polar ice caps. You know, Mars has plenty of water. It's frozen, but it's also frozen on the ice caps where it's concentrated, and you can melt it. By melting the ice, rivers will once again flow on Mars, which will create a greenhouse effect. The more water vapor you have, the more heat you get captured by the planet Mars. And you can even induce an artificial greenhouse effect if you want. The point is that if you can raise the temperature of Mars by 6 degrees, you can set off a runaway greenhouse effect and warm the entire planet. And one day, terraform it so it becomes like the planet Earth. Well, that completes the first part of exploration. In the second part of exploration, we're going to talk about black holes. That is, not just planets, galaxies, but perhaps the most strangest, most exotic object in the universe, black holes. And we see now literally thousands of them in outer space. Our special guest today is Dr. Fulvia Melia, one of the world's leading experts on black hole physics. And he's a professor of astronomy at the University of Arizona. So stay tuned now as we explore the world of black holes, the strangest object in the entire universe of ours. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we talked about Mars and the universe, and the second half of Exploration, we're going to talk about one of the strangest objects in the universe, and that is a black hole. You know, when I was a grad student years ago, the whole concept of a black hole was so science fiction that people would giggle and laugh whenever you mentioned it at a physics conference. But now we see them in outer space, or at least we see the after effects of gigantic amounts of stars and gases being sucked into the heart of a black hole. It's no longer science fiction at all. In fact, my colleague, Stephen Hawking, who recently passed away, almost won a Nobel Prize for the black hole. Now, what Stephen Hawking showed was that black holes, even though they gobble up everything, including light, are not really black at all. They glow a little bit. They emit what is called Hawking radiation. So black holes are actually gray rather than being totally black. So why didn't Stephen win the Nobel Prize in physics? It's sad, but, you know, this Hawking radiation is very faint. So faint that we're not going to be able to detect it with our instruments for many a decade. And so this means that even though Hawking showed that black holes have to obey the laws of quantum mechanics, that is, they have to gently emit radiation, it turns out the radiation is so faint that, well, we're not going to be able to measure it for quite a while. Anyway, with us today to talk about the mechanics of black holes is Fulvia Melia. He's a professor of astronomy at the University of Arizona, one of the leading figures in black hole research. And so once again, our special guest today is Fulvia Melia, and we are talking about black holes in outer space.
And now I'd like to introduce our special guest for today. We're very delighted to have with us Dr. Fulvia Melia. He is the chairman of the physics department at the University of Arizona at Tucson, one of the centers of black hole physics. And he's the author of a new book called The Edge of Infinity, about black holes. So let's now get a few definitions off the ground before we head right into the center of a black hole. First of all, what is a black hole? Well, a black hole is an object whose escape velocity is the speed of light. In other words, light itself cannot escape a black hole. In other words, everything falls in, but nothing falls out. And then surrounding the black hole, there is a sphere called the event horizon. And the event horizon is the point of no return. If you fall through that imaginary sphere, you get sucked right into the black hole and you never come out again. And lastly, we have two types of black holes, stellar black holes, that is old stars that peter out and collapse into a black hole, and galactic black holes, like at the center of the Milky Way galaxy itself, right in our own backyard. So once again, our special guest today is Dr. Fulvia Melia, and we are talking about one of the strangest objects in the universe, and that is the black hole. The first question for you is, how did you first get interested in physics and astronomy?
Well, I actually grew up in Melbourne, and I don't know if all of your listeners have had the opportunity of visiting the Southern Hemisphere, but looking up at the sky from the Southern Hemisphere, one gets quite a different view than from the Northern Hemisphere. The Milky Way, for example, is very easily seen, and it stretches from one horizon to the next, and it fills the cosmic vault. And when I was small, I remember almost every evening just going outdoors and just looking at the stars and the Milky Way for hours and hours and hours. And I would say that that's probably what started me off. With that, of course, comes the natural curiosity of how things work and what these objects are, and one is led, I think, in most cases, to study of physics, and that's what got me into physics and astronomy, I would say.
And Arizona is one of the world's leading centers for astronomical research, I understand. So what is it like to be in Arizona versus being in New York City, to be able to look up at the night sky and see the Milky Way, and also to be at the very forefront of telescope technology?
Well, that's the interesting comparison, of course, because even though I usually tell my friends, especially the ones overseas, even though we belong to the same country, the southwest of the United States is really very, very different from the northeast, as I think everybody realizes. Here in Arizona, the skies are almost always clear. It's not a coincidence that many of the national and now the international telescope facilities are being built here. We get very little cloud cover during the year, so going out in the evening, whether using a telescope or not, presents quite a glorious experience. It's a wonderful opportunity to feel the magnitude of the skies and the objects there. And of course, for research, especially for the observers and people who build instruments eventually placed on the telescopes with which these observations are made, there are very few places on the planet better than this to do studies such as this. The clarity of the skies and also the access to objects, not only in the northern hemisphere, but those approaching what one would see from the southern hemisphere. Of course, Earth's rim prevents us from seeing all of the portion of the Milky Way that would be accessible from the south, but nonetheless, during a portion of the year, we can still see the center of the galaxy, for example, which is close to the southern horizon for us here in Arizona. But other than the skies here, the only other place that would present a comparable opportunity for studying these objects would be from countries such as Chile, which of course is way down south. So as far as we here in the United States are concerned, unless we want to travel to South America, this is probably the place to do this type of work.
And also, tell us a little bit about how stars die and the formation of black holes.
Right. Well, this of course is an ongoing investigation. We think we understand some pieces of the puzzle. Not everything is known. It's quite a long story. Black holes can actually form in several ways, and it's not clear that the supermassive objects that we see in the nuclei of galaxies form through the stellar process of life and then death. They may have formed in other ways, and we may come back to this in a few moments when we talk about the genesis of these objects early on after the Big Bang. But in terms of the smaller black holes, like the ones like Cygnus X-1, for example, these are the objects that we think weigh perhaps 10 to 20 times as much as the Sun. As far as these objects are concerned, most of them are produced when a very massive star. And by very massive, we mean something, an object that weighs anywhere between 30 to 50 times the mass of the Sun, burns its nuclear fuel rather quickly, it turns out, because the more massive the object is, the faster it burns the fuel, and then eventually loses that internal support that prevents it from collapsing to the middle. It's the heat generated from nuclear burning that preserves the star during the main part of its life, like the Sun is now. And at the end, when that nuclear fuel is burned to heavier elements, such as carbon and eventually to iron, the heat generation stops and the material can't support itself anymore and collapses into the middle, at which point a supernova explosion ensues and the remnant, depending on how massive the original star was, can sometimes be a black hole with a mass somewhere between a couple of solar masses and 10 to 20, as I said earlier. So the vast majority of black holes about which we know, and there are some billion of these in the galaxy, probably formed in this way. But there is another class of objects, like the one at the center of our galaxy and the center of many other galaxies, such as the Andromeda Galaxy, our sister galaxy. These objects have a mass anywhere between a million to several billion times the mass of the Sun. And although some of them may have started as seeds from supernova explosions a long, long time ago and eventually have grown to the point where they are now, it's not clear that all of them could have formed that way. And the reason I say that, and this would lead into another part of the story, The reason I say that is that we now have very, very strong evidence that at least some of these supermassive objects were formed only 700 million years after the Big Bang, much, much earlier than the formation of galaxies and much of the structure that we see in the universe today. So it's starting to look like there was some other mechanism, some other process that led to this early collapse and this catastrophic creation of very strong gravity surrounding these objects, which probably also then acted as nucleation sites that attracted other matter towards them. And that matter, we think, in many cases, may have led to the formation of galaxies. So the odd thing now is that we may actually owe our existence to the formation of these supermassive black holes, because they may have been the seeds that created galaxies, which then, of course, created stars within them and planets and life and so on. So it's quite a long, complex story, and we don't know all the details yet, but some of the pieces of the puzzle are starting to emerge, in that there definitely appear to be several classes of these, and one class having to do with the supermassive objects somehow had a genesis much, much earlier than we thought before, and how they formed is not entirely clear yet.
Well, I have a question that many young people ask about black holes. First of all, black holes suck in everything. Even light itself cannot escape. In some sense, they're the ultimate roach hotel. And the Hubble Space Telescope has photographed black holes eating up whole star systems. So in other words, things check into a black hole, but nothing ever checks out. Well, then the question is, well, a black hole should be invisible. Even light itself cannot escape from a black hole. Therefore, a black hole should be invisible. And yet we have the Hubble Space Telescope taking photographs of perhaps hundreds of black holes in outer space. And so then the question is, how do you photograph something that is invisible?
Right. This is this is what's really generating much of the excitement these days with theoretical astrophysicists and, of course, the physics community in general. What telescopes that have been built up to this point have seen so far is not really the black hole itself, but what they see is light produced by matter falling into the black hole. Their resolution is not yet good enough for them to make an image of the black hole itself, the event horizon, which is the surface beyond which nothing can escape, including light. So if we really could see the black hole itself, what we would see is a dark shadow in front of a curtain of light. The curtain of light presumably would be produced by matter behind the black hole relative to us, and the black hole would absorb all of the light produced behind it or redirect it away from our line of sight, because gravity can bend the path of light. And so we would see a dark shadow. That's what a black hole would look like if we had a camera with such clarity, such spatial resolution, that we could see detail down to that size. It does look like by the end of the decade, we may have the capability of actually forming such an image. But for now, telescopes such as Hubble and Chandra have not been able to do that yet. So instead, what they show us is images, or what they produce is images of matter falling into the black hole from larger distances much further away than the event horizon itself. Both have done spectacularly in this regard, though. Both Chandra, the X-ray telescope, and Hubble have each produced a very deep image of certain patches of the sky. By deep, we mean that there were patches in the sky, such as one in the constellation of Ursa Major, where there are very, very few objects within our own galaxy inside of that patch. And so it's like looking through a relatively open window to distances much further away than objects within our galaxy. And what they were able to do by staring at these patches was to collect light from objects some 10 to 12 billion light years away. In other words, objects that were producing this light only 700 to 800, 900 million years after the Big Bang. And what they see when they look at these patches is very bright objects, either X-ray objects or ultraviolet or infrared objects in the case of Hubble, objects that number as many as 500 within a region only the size of the full moon. So if you can imagine with your eye looking at a part of the sky that has the size of the full moon, within such a region, these telescopes have been able to produce images of as many as 500 of these objects. And these objects are so far away, they're so bright, that the only way that they could produce this much light is if they're black holes absorbing matter from their environment and converting gravitational and rest mass energy into light. So we believe that when we look at these patches, most of the objects that we see, most of the 500, must be supermassive black holes at that distance in the universe. And what's interesting is that when one extrapolates over the whole sky, these numbers correspond to total numbers of some 300 to 400 million such objects. And we know that that's not all that's there, because that's what we can count, that's what we can see. But some of these objects are probably also obscured by dusty matter falling in towards them, and so it's not clear that we're seeing everything. So the best that we can say is that there must be at least 300 million of these supermassive black holes spread throughout the cosmos. Chandra, of course, has gone on and done even much better than that. It's allowed us to look at the supermassive black hole at the center of our own galaxy with even better clarity, because it's much closer than the others. It's only 25,000 light years away compared to the 12 billion light years of many of these other objects near the beginning of the universe's life. And because this object at the center of our galaxy is so close, we've been able to study it with Chandra and now other instruments as well. The European Space Agency has its own X-ray telescope called XMM-Newton, which has done similarly spectacular studies of these objects. But with Chandra, we've been able to see the X-rays produced by the black hole at the center of our galaxy with enough resolution that we can actually place the source, the location of the emitting plasma, within a region no bigger than the distance between the Earth and the Sun. In addition, this object seems to explode roughly once a day, producing a flare of X-rays. The X-ray intensity during these events goes up by anywhere between 30 and 200 times what the intensity is during the quiescent state. And so for a couple of hours, the black hole at the center of our galaxy shines much, much brighter than it otherwise does. And what's intriguing now, and these are the latest results that haven't even been published in the literature, what's intriguing now is that there is very clear evidence that during these events, we can see a periodic pulse. It's like the heartbeat of this object. There's a periodic pulse that occurs roughly once every 20 minutes. The natural interpretation for this, and again, it hasn't been published yet, so we have to look at this more carefully and make sure that we've ruled out all the other possibilities, but the natural interpretation is that what we're looking at is a phenomenon associated with X-rays being produced in a region orbiting the black hole within a distance only 3 to 4 times the size of the event horizon. So although we can't see the event horizon just yet with Chandra or Hubble, nonetheless, we're seeing a phenomenon associated with emission that's occurring only 2 to 3 times the size of the event horizon. It's similar to what would happen if you imagine putting a searchlight on a planet and being in its focal cone only when the searchlight is pointing towards you. And so you would see a pulse every time the planet goes around the sun, which would then lead to a periodicity or a period of 1 year in the case of the Earth, because that's how long it takes the Earth to go around the Sun. So it's a similar phenomenon with the black hole at the galactic center. We see this pulsation roughly every 20 minutes, and so we interpret that as being a part of the plasma in orbit around the black hole, and the distance that corresponds to that period is about three times the size of the event horizon. So these are some of the most exciting things that are happening now as we speak, and the prospects will get only better as time passes and Chandra and XMM continue to look and discover additional activity and also with the next generation of telescopes in the pipeline now.
Now, everyone asks the question, what happens if you fall into a black hole? No one's ever done that, of course. But could you explain some of the distortions of space-time that occur if you were to fall into a black hole and someone were to observe you falling into a black hole from a distant planet?
Right. And the answer to that, of course, depends, not surprisingly, on how massive the black hole is. What one would see falling through the event horizon differs depending on how massive the black hole is compared to the mass of the object or the body falling in. It turns out that for a massive object like the one at the galactic center, which we now understand has roughly 3 million solar masses worth of material contained within it, falling through the event horizon of an object like that, a person would actually not see very much, would actually not feel very strong effects on his or her body. There would be other distortions to the light, but we'll come back to that in a moment. The point is that what happens physically to matter falling through the event horizon depends on how big the object falling in is compared to how big the event horizon is. And the size of the event horizon scales with the mass of the black hole. So, for example, if the Sun were to shrink down to the size of a black hole, its event horizon would have a radius of only 3 kilometers, smaller than a city. Whereas the black hole at the galactic center has an event horizon with a radius about 1/20th the distance between the Earth and the Sun, which is much, much bigger, of course, than 3 kilometers. And it's the difference or the comparison between the size of the event horizon and the size of the object falling in that determines how much physical damage, if we can put it that way, is done to the object falling in. So because our body is so small compared to the size of the event horizon of the black hole, the galactic center, we could fall right through and not feel very much physical damage. We wouldn't get distorted or pulled or stretched or compressed. We would be able to pass through the event horizon, and then other catastrophic events would ensue, I'm sure, after that. But the process of falling in wouldn't do damage to us. On the other hand, if we were to fall through a smaller black hole, like the Sun, again, if the Sun were to be compressed to 3 kilometer size, then our body would get stretched at first, pulled apart, and catastrophic damage would follow. We would be disintegrated, and only the atoms and molecules would fall through. So the physical damage is different depending on the size. And a good analogy would be compare standing on the surface of the Earth, where the surface of the Earth, even though it's spherical, looks flat to us because it's so much bigger than us, and then standing on the dome of a cathedral. The dome is also quasi-spherical at the top, but because the size of the sphere is much smaller compared to the Earth and much closer to our size, we feel the curvature of the dome much, much more. And so that's the analogy. A small black hole, because of its greater curvature relative to us, would do more damage to our body falling through than a big black hole does. Now, that's as far as physical damage is concerned. But what we see, though, would be less dependent on the size, and there would be significant distortion to the light path progressively as we get closer and closer to the event horizon. So light, because of gravitational redshift, meaning that photons have progressively less and less energy, not speed. The speed of light is always the same, but the energy of the photons decreases relative to us at infinity as they get closer and closer to the event horizon. Because of that decreasing energy, we have greater and greater difficulty seeing the light. Eventually, as the as the light reaches the event horizon, it's lost all of its energy relative to what we see, and so we wouldn't be able to even detect the light anymore, even though it would still be coming out until it passes through the event horizon, and beyond that, we wouldn't see it anymore. But as we fall in, because of this effect, we would tend to see primarily light concentrated closer and closer to the zenith angle, right above our head. So as we get closer to the event horizon, we see a progressively smaller cone of light from the rest of the universe until that point when we cross the event horizon itself, and only the light coming directly down would be visible to us. And so we would see these significant distortions because of the light bending and the gravitational redshift. And when we cross the event horizon, then, of course, nothing can go back out, so we can't communicate with the outside world. But what we would see is only light falling directly inwards towards us.
And that, of course, leads us to the final question for which there's no definitive answer. And that is, if you fall into a black hole, then where do you go? Where do you wind up? Well, there are many theories. One theory simply says you die and you're crushed at the very center of the black hole. Other theories say that there is a gateway to another universe. And perhaps you'll be ejected as a white hole, which is on the other side of a black hole, which means that our black hole universe could be connected to many other parallel universes, giving us a multiverse of universes. Well, at the present time, we need a theory of everything to resolve the problem. And for that, we have to resort to something called string theory, which is what I do for a living. But that's a whole nother story, because string theory has not yet been verified using our atom smashers. Sorry about that. Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, our special guest today was Professor Fulvia Melia, Professor of Astronomy at the University of Arizona, and we were talking about one of the strangest objects in the entire universe, and that is the black hole. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. Once again, for a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. So once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku for Exploration. Good day.